Okay, 3, 2.
3, 2, hit it! It's time to double down with Max and Stacy on Sputnik Radio. Coming up on the show, we talk to Steve Keen. But first, as always, it's time to hear from Stacy with hot headlines of the day.
Max, I think the hottest headline of the past week was natural gas gets a Trump-friendly rebrand as Freedom Gas. The Trump administration has rebranded natural gas with a new patriotic-sounding name, Freedom Gas, and a Department of Energy press release. Energy Undersecretary of Energy, Mark W. Menezes, talked about exporting U.S. natural gas as spreading freedom gas throughout the world, and he called it natural gas from the U.S., molecules of U.S. freedom.
Well, you know, America has copyrighted the word freedom. We own freedom. Only thing that we can possibly say is that anyone else tries to think in those terms or use the word freedom, we're going to come and remember freedom fries? You know, this is freedom gas, molecules of freedom. You know, it's a really interesting slogan. However, it is meaningless.
Well, it is meaningless because, of course, freedom gas is not free. In fact, it costs much more than what the Europeans pay currently for their natural gas from Russia, from Algeria, and places like that. And this is part of the, I guess, the propaganda to get Europeans to buy LNG from America, where we have, you know, all that fracking going on, and we're losing money on fracking here in the United States, partly because there's an overabundance of it, so it's super cheap here, but it's much more expensive in Europe and Asia, so we're exporting it. But of course, that doesn't matter to any European or Americans because we have free money. So we're going to talk to Steve Keen now, and he is the author of Debunking Economics. And first, Steve Keen, I know you're on your way to the Extinction Rebellion in London. Tell us about what the Extinction Rebellion is, how it relates to the Gilets Jaunes, how it relates to freedom gas and these energy wars going on around the world.
Well, it's basically kids saying, take the situation seriously, you adults, otherwise known as, because we're looking at what's happening, both in what we've experienced in our own lives and what we've seen in the scientific data, and you're just not taking it seriously. It's about time you did, and we're going to make life uncomfortable for you until you start taking it seriously. I think it's quite a remarkable rebellion coming from school students, and I don't think there's anything like it ever before in our history, that kids have taken to the streets like this.
Right. You know, what's interesting, Steve Keen, you're an economist. Let's talk about the economics of extinction. Okay, you're going to the Extinction Rebellion in London. You know, there is a thing in the world, the economics of extinction. I'm thinking about the bluefish fishermen in Japan who are purposefully fishing the tuna into extinction because they have a lot in the freezer, and the value of the ones in the freezer goes up. Also, other wildlife, you know, with various appendages that are valuable in the aftermarket are also being hunted to extinction because it makes the value of the inventory go up. So this is economically viable, and we live in a world that is a slave to neoliberal economics, to monetarism, to central banks as deities. So, I mean, how do you know, it's a pretty deep issue. It sounds logical, like, oh, we don't want to become extinct, but it is profitable, Steve.
It's profitable for a while, Max, but this is the trouble. And this is why I'm just taking the war cannon to William Nordhaus over this, because the dangers of climate change have been played down by so much by the mainstream economists in particular, who are arguing that we should just be using a nice old carbon tax to control prices and thereby influence people to buy less carbon-based fuels and buy more, buy less freedom gas, or buy freedom gas rather than buying coal. And they're downplaying the dangers. They're actually ignoring works by the scientists, saying that there are tipping points where we go past a particular point, everything just breaks down, and that could happen in our lifetimes. And literally, some of the people who think they're profiting from this right now could be fleeing to their bolt holes in New Zealand and Caribbean islands in the next one or two decades, given how seriously bad this is. So it goes beyond the extinction trade. I agree with you on the examples about the tuna and things like that. You know, if you kill living tuna, then the frozen ones you've got are worth more, and bang, you make a profit out of it. But you live to get the profit, and you can enjoy the profit in your home country. If this goes on the way we look, the scientists are looking at it, where we could be as little as 20 years away from a point at which serious things in the climate start to break down, like the Gulf Stream. That's more long term, but the breakdown in such a way that we have a runaway increase in temperature. We get to being 6 degrees above what we are currently now, not within our lifetimes, but pretty damn soon afterwards. And the whole system will fall apart, and you won't be able to cash those chips in at the capitalist casino.
Now, the left-wing press has played quite a big role in saying natural gas is more environmentally friendly than coal. And so this increase in natural gas usage is a positive thing. But of course, this freedom gas comes from LNG terminals, which are put on ships and sent across the Atlantic Ocean over to Europe. And shipping, of course, is one of the number one emitters of carbon in the world. So we have this freedom gas. Is not only is it going to be more expensive, but tying this into your Extinction Rebellion and the Gilets Jaunes, which we were talking about in our neoliberal economics, you know, and that includes the left-wing media, I might say, the cable news in America anyway, is that in the Gilets Jaunes protests, what we saw is that the cost of the elite, all the damage they've done to both the monetary, fiscal, economic, and environmental systems is being paid for by those who can least afford it, whether it's in the developing world or our own developed economies where the poor are asked and demanded to pay the most for these carbon taxes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I tie Gilets Jaunes and the Extinction Rebellion together because they're both rebelling not against action against climate change, but the type of action that's being proposed by economists like Nordhaus. Because what they're saying is, let's just make it, reduce the amount of carbon we're consuming by putting up the price a bit by taxes. And of course, that's fine if you've got the income to cover it. But if you're living in a minimum wage job, and there are many, many people doing decent things like nurses and firemen, for example, who are earning minimum wages these days, a slight increase in the price, like what Macron did with putting extra taxes on diesel back in France at the end of last year, can go send you from worrying about whether you can afford the feeding the kids and getting them to school to knowing you can't do both. And at that point, just get on the streets and you start demonstrating. So price is not a price signal anymore. It's a rationing system that penalizes the poor and lets the rich get away. And I think what we're facing is that when we realize just how serious climate change is, we won't be able to use a price-based rationing system, because if we do, it'll be pitchforks. It won't be a polite protest, a relatively polite protest in London or burning a few cars in France. It'll be outright rebellion, because if we use the price system to control who gets access to energy after it becomes impossible to provide as much as people are consuming now without destroying the biosphere, there'll be class warfare. So the only way around it is actual, I think, ultimately, outright rationing, war-style rationing. And that's not at all what, of course, the neoliberal agenda wants to do, but that's where it's driving us.
All right. So you mentioned that the timeline in our lifetimes probably will have a runaway climate catastrophe. So 20, as you mentioned, 20 years, you know, for someone like myself who's pushing 60, okay, I'll be 80. I'll be checking out. It won't be a big deal for me. But somebody who is 20 years old, and these are the folks who are going to this event, the Extinction Rebellion in London, this is real for them. They face premature extinction as a species. So I guess they are beginning to realize that they've got an existential threat here. So they're starting to, how much of this is really getting through to this next generation? Do they realize they're about to become extinct?
I think it's only a handful that have got that awareness right now. I mean, there's the students who are going out and demonstrating in London, certainly aren't the entire population of London school students, but they're a leading phalanx of that group. And I think it's good that they're there, because we're going to have to realize just how serious this is. And it's not being done by the politicians. It's certainly not being done by the economists, who are downplaying all the dangers and saying that, in fact, Nordhaus actually says that the optimum temperature for the planet is 4 degrees warmer than now. And at the same time, climate scientists are saying, if we hit 2 degrees, we're going to lose the Arctic sea ice, and that'll set off a chain reaction amongst other tipping elements in the climate, like the greenhouse, the Greenland ice sheet, like West Antarctic, like the thermocline circulation that keeps Europe warm. And they'll all go haywire, and we can end up with a planet that's 8 or 12 degrees above current levels, and at that point, it will be extinction. I applaud the students for starting it, but I think we've got a long way to go before the realization really sinks in.
Well, let's talk about the extinction of our financial system and price signals, because you're over in Europe, and in Europe, we have close to $11 trillion in negative yielding sovereign debt, and it's escalating rapidly. So in terms of this neoliberal economy into which these 20-year-olds are graduating from university, what happens in Europe in your systems sort of analysis at negative rates already when we're at a peak of a cycle? We've had a 10-year bull market now. Like, what happens when it crashes and we're already still in negative territory? What will central banks, what will governments do when we already have Gilets Jaunes, we already have Extinction Rebellion, we already have deplorables, nobody has meaningful jobs, we're facing trade wars and deglobalization. So what happens in the next crash? What happens, what can central banks do? What will they do in the next crash?
Well, they certainly can't use the price mechanism anymore. This is the whole conventional neoliberal argument is that prices are signals about what to produce. So if you have a higher price for one model of car than another, that's a signal there's more demand for it and so on. It's never worked that way. It's really a rationing system between the rich and poor. That's what prices fundamentally function as. And the rationing, the income inequality is so extreme. That's why we're seeing things like the Gilets Jaunes happening now, that if you continue trying to use the price system for any reason, that includes the price of money, you're just going to cause open rebellion. And it won't work anyway. It won't give you the results that they have in their theory. So I think what we're going to see is central banks will be basically forced to produce as much money as is needed to devote as many resources as we possibly can to trying to get ourselves off our carbon dependence right now, and do that in a panic mode. And the only way to be able to do it simultaneously with the society is to have rationing, to bring in wartime rationing. Back in the days of this first, Second World War, I think you were allowed in like one pack of cigarettes a week. It'll be the same sort of thing, so many ounces of fuel a week. And that freedom gas, you're not going to get free access to that freedom gas. It's going to be rationed. So I think it'll be a complete breakdown of the neoliberal myth that you can manage everything using relative prices and the price of money.
Okay, Steve, you mentioned price signaling there. It's a very important part of capitalism, allocation of risk and reward. In Australia, the price signal for housing was messed up because the government kept subsidizing for years and years and years. And then finally, they couldn't do it anymore, it appears. And now the prices are tumbling. Is that a correct assessment, number one? And number two, have they stopped tumbling?
No, the prices are still falling, Max. But the thing that's different is this has been happening right since the early 1960s. And we've had the price of money go up and the price of money go down dramatically in that period. You had, you know, during the Vaucluse period, you guys had America had interest rates of 17%, and Australia was actually for mortgage rates up to 22%. So even despite those increases and decreases in the price of money, the level of debts continued rising all the way through. And that's really what the government's been pushing. They don't know it. What actually drives house prices is rising levels of household credit. And they've been encouraging people to borrow more and more money for housing. And they've finally reached the point where the household sector is pretty much at saturation or beyond saturation. Debt levels are now falling, and that's driving house prices down. And in Australia, in the major cities, they've fallen by more than 10% since they peaked back in 2017. Now, we haven't quite reached the panic stage yet, because it takes a couple of years for panic to actually set in terms of how the policymakers react to this. So they're trying to keep the bubble going, but I think they've reached the absolute breaking point, and it might pick up for a while after the unexpected election of the Conservatives down here, otherwise known as Liberals in Australia. But I think it'll die, and then bang, it'll be head down and panic stations in about a year's time.
Final question, Steve Keen. No nation is more obedient to the U.S. empire than Australia, but no nation is more reliant on trade with China than Australia. So what happens to China in this Cold War emerging between the U.S. and China?
I think Australia makes the wrong choice and jumps on the one that loses, and currently it's backing America. I think I should be backing China.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this episode of Double Down with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert on Sputnik Radio. I'd like to thank our guest, Steve Keen. Until next week, bye, y'all.